Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. For years, many on the right have been lambasting a certain kind of progressive sensibility. Think about the ubiquity of political correctness in the 1990s, endless fodder for Rush Limbaugh and talk radio. But the furor over PC was nothing compared to the political battle over woke.
You know what woke means? It means you're a loser. Everything woke. It's true. Everything woke turns to shit, okay? It's true.
There's Donald Trump in 2021, and the next year, Ron DeSantis signed into law a controversial Stop Woke Act in the state of Florida. It was absolutely the centerpiece of his recent re-election victory speech.
We fight the woke in the legislature. We fight the woke in the schools. We fight the woke in the corporations. We will never, ever surrender to the woke mob. Florida is where woke goes to die.
In Washington, in the House of Representatives, there's talk of forming an anti-woke caucus.
Where do you start on an anti-woke caucus?
Most Republicans are now awakened to this fact that wokeness is weakness. It's a cancer that's eating America from inside out. You look at the recruiting numbers in the United States military, way off of its goals because...
For conservatives now, wokeness is the root cause of everything negative, from lower military recruitment to deadly mass shootings, as one senator insisted after the shooting in Uvalde, Texas. But what does woke actually mean? We asked a few people.
So my initial thoughts on the word woke were really benign. They were words of warning to be aware of your surroundings.
I've always thought it sounded a little silly. Even when it first popped up, just the word, you know, it still implies that everybody else is asleep and everybody else is the problem, but I'm not.
I like the woke concept because I feel like more people should be aware of their surroundings and what's going on in their community, and I feel there's a reason why things are the way they are.
I couldn't tell you when I first heard it, but the context was always with Black people. Black people were the only ones that were using the word woke or making any reference to staying woke. Always Black people.
And then I had a coworker who would sing Stay Woke.
To be honest, any associations I have with what it meant pre, 2020 have been like totally supplanted by like the fact that it's a polemic now. So when I hear it, I just access like what's been taken and I don't really access like what the source of the word was. It's always with like a sardonic tone. It's always like with air quotes. It's often like people in my milieu who still kind of associate themselves with like progressivism, but are using the term like in this weird way that feels like they've also absorbed what like the right in America have co-opted it to be, like they now that's their primary frame of reference.
Wokeness calls out to people who are skeptics and cynical that, yeah, everything's effed up, and this is a problem, and that's a problem, that person's a problem, and you think like that, and that's a problem, and every white person is racist, and we need to cancel all this stuff. It gave power to people who, to me, just had a lot of negativity to spew.
I currently have a very good friend who is white, who every time I talk to him complains about how woke his workplace is. He works at the Navy. The United States Navy. Which is to say, you can see what somebody's so upset about because it's like, what are you complaining? What is the issue?
To get a deeper insight on how such an ambiguous term became so powerful in this country and well beyond, I spoke with Tony Thorne. He's a linguist and a lexicographer based in the UK, and he wrote the Dictionary of Contemporary Slang. Slang is definitely his thing.
Technically, this language is quite sophisticated. It uses metaphors, metonymy, synecdoche, rhetoric, sound symbolism. It's technically quite sophisticated. Even if it's non-standard language that many people see as deficient or incorrect slang, it's an important part of society, whether you like it or not.
Tony, when did you start hearing or becoming aware of the word that is now ubiquitous, woke?
I came across woke, I think, around at the time of Black Lives Matter, when that movement and that phenomenon started to trend. So probably around 2014. So the word, of course, had been around for much longer, but that's when it started trending on social media and in discussions of politics and culture.
My understanding of the word is that it's been around for a very long time, particularly in the Black community, particularly in the United States.
It actually probably goes right back to the 19th century, because woke is, it's a non-standard, therefore not really correct form of the verb to wake or awaken. And it's a non-standard past participle. So instead of saying, I was woken up or I was awakened, not just Black people or people of color, but also I think Southern white speakers in the Southern states of the U.S. would have said this, I got woke, I was woke. So it's a dialect. It's a kind of informal dialect term, but it was very much part of African American vernacular English.
And when does it take on its political sense of awareness?
I think in conversation, it probably happened in the 60s. But the earliest record we can find of it, I think I'm right, was in 1971. There was a play produced in the U.S. by someone called Barry Beckham, called Garvey Lives, talking about Marcus Garvey, the sort of Black liberationist. And in this play, they repeated the phrase, Mr. Garvey says, I must stay woke, I must be woke. So that was 1971. The word still didn't become common, wasn't used by many people publicly, I think, until 2008, when a singer called Erykah Badu produced a song called Master Teacher. And she also, it's part of that song, kind of chorus, used the word stay woke. I must stay woke, or you must stay woke.
Now I stay woke. What if it was the only master teaches now, I stay woke. Even if your baby ain't got no money to support you, baby, now I stay woke.
So it was 2008 that it kind of transferred into popular culture, I think, in the US, not in the UK. We didn't hear about it until Black Lives Matter popularized. The references to woke before 2016, 17, 18 were kind of sort of straightforward. It means socially aware. It means empathetic. Afterwards, the definitions changed to it means self-righteous. It means pretending to be socially aware. So the term has already become twisted, if you like, and become difficult to use. Then the right, the conservative right, seizes hold of this word in order to jeer at what they see as the self-righteous left.
Okay, one House lawmaker taking on a new battle to combat wokeness across the country, which he calls the greatest domestic threat facing America. I think he's right.
Now when I pick up the right-wing press, I see Fox News, I see the Daily Mail in Britain.
Oh, yes.
Woke is the center of the right-wing platform, not any particular fiscal policy. It's, when I hear Ron DeSantis, it's all about we are the center of the anti-woke movement. That's what the rhetoric of the campaign is, because it seems to connect more easily than complicated policy prescriptions about foreign policy or domestic policy. Am I right?
I think you're absolutely right, linguistically. I think woke is a very interesting term right now, because I think that it's an unusable word, although it is used all the time, because it doesn't actually mean anything. Rather, like I think in the US, Antifa has come. Perhaps it did mean something. Perhaps it did describe an actual grouping. But it's come to be a sort of shorthand for everybody we disagree with. And I think woke has become a lazy slur.
Are we fighting about language more than we did before?
Yes. What has happened to public language, public discourse, the language used in the media, at least, and on social media, which is the new phenomenon? What I think has happened in the last decades is this. If you want even perhaps your opponents in the media to reproduce your message, you need to cultivate them. And you need to join in with them in the messaging procedure. And Bill Clinton, then emulated by Tony Blair, picked up spin and the notion of the spin doctors. But then what happened is this same process evolved and became more and more, if you like, divisive. So that then you have Steve Bannon advising Donald Trump, and shortly afterwards, the same thing happened. Bannon's playbook was picked up enthusiastically by Dominic Cummings, who played the same role for Boris Johnson. Only now it's different. It's not spin anymore. It's something far more aggressive. Bannon himself used terms like fire hosing, like flooding the zone. And what he meant by that was overwhelming your opponents with a barrage of messages using very strong language, not simply to counter their arguments. It wasn't about just putting your own spin, your own bias on some piece of news. It was about destroying their credibility, denigrating them, and overwhelming them so that your opponents become unable to express themselves or even to unable to understand the public discourse. So if you see what I'm getting at, it's a process which, when we look back, is perhaps a coherent evolution of public language, political language, contentious language, but it has now reached the stage of divisiveness, what I call toxic terminology and weaponized words, which is far, far, far more aggressive and difficult to negotiate than it was 20 years ago.
So you fully expect that woke will be the dominant term on the right as we head toward elections in 2024?
It seems that the right, if I look at it from their point of view, why should they let go of it? Why should they abandon it just because it's meaningless? Because it works. This is exactly Steve Bannon's and Dominic Cummings. Dominic Cummings won Brexit with this tactic, with this playbook. Don't argue with them. Don't counter their arguments. Don't present facts. Just demolish them with whatever words you can find that work. And that's what woke is still working, because for people in the UK, I think if you go into a bar or you're talking to your neighbor across the garden fence, you'll hear a lot of ordinary people who may not be bigots or may be bigots, but who pick this term up and use it quite cheerfully. And the left can't do anything about it. The left can't stop them using it.
Finally, are there any new words that you're hearing that we're not maybe as aware of, that are joining woke as toxic terminology?
There's a comical term that is used in the UK, which I don't think is ever used in the US, which is gammon, G-A-M-M-O-N. It's gammon is a kind of boiled ham that was a kind of proletariat meal that not very sophisticated people eat. And a gammon means a red-faced, angry, white, old bigot. The image they're trying to evoke is the boiling hot rage and the bright orange-red complexion of this furious right-wing guy with no hair and a huge beer belly. And it, again, like woke, it's very useful shorthand because we don't have another word in the English language, in slang even, that covers all those connotations. White, angry, bigoted, right-wing, middle-aged or old, all of those features of that that word. So we had to invent one, and the left invented gammon, sometimes elaborated into gammonista. So the left does it too.
Tony Thorne, thank you so much. That was wonderful.
It was a pleasure. I apologize if I became heated.
Tony Thorne is the author of The Dictionary of Contemporary Slang. And by the way, we published a profile last year of Ron DeSantis, which touched on his anti-woke crusade and a great deal more. That profile was by Dexter Filkins, and you can find it at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, with more to come.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Since the end of Roe v. Wade, and in fact even before, many states have enacted bans or effective bans on abortion. One of the most fraught questions has been what exceptions should be made and when, if any at all. Exceptions in the case of pregnancy from rape or incest used to be considered necessary, even within the pro-life movement, and that's all changed. To date, 10 states have no rape exception in their abortion restrictions. More will likely consider moving in that direction this year. And as some members of Congress weigh the idea of a federal abortion ban, the question now concerns every one of us.
I think few people understand how common this scenario actually is. According to the CDC, almost 3 million women in the U.S. have become pregnant as a result of rape.
Recently, the New Yorker's Eren Orbe took a closer look at what happens when a woman conceives during an act of sexual assault and what happens when those pregnancies go to term.
There's one woman in particular whose story really stuck with me. I'm going to call her Teresa. She told me that when she first discovered she was pregnant, this was back in 2016, she was in her mid-30s, she was in a good place in her career, and she felt ready to have a child.
The day I found out I was pregnant, I went to Rite Aid because my period hadn't started. So I said, let me just go to Rite Aid and take a pregnancy test. And I took it right there in the bathroom of the Rite Aid, in the dirty restroom. I took the pregnancy test, and it was positive. And when I saw that, I just lit up. Like, I wanted the whole store to know that I was pregnant.
She found out at her first prenatal appointment that she was actually pregnant with twins, a girl and a boy. During her pregnancy, her relationship with her partner at the time ended up falling apart. But she still wanted to raise the twins. She felt that she had the support she needed from her family to make it work.
When I gave birth in the hospital, they were asking about what the twins' last name was going to be and who the father is. And I said, I wanted it to be my last name. And I put down my ex as the father. And I filed for child support because I needed financial help for two babies. And we had a hearing in November of 2017. And in that hearing, I'll never forget it, the first thing the judge said out his mouth was, the gentleman is not the father. I said, what? I said, there's no way. There is no way that's not possible. He must have paid somebody to take his paternity test, or he must have lied, or they must have made a mistake. Now, at this time, I knew that I had been sexually assaulted. And it was during the time that I was with my ex. So I never thought in a million years that the gentleman could be the father of the twins. But in order to eliminate him, I asked him to take a paternity test and he complied.
What Teresa told me is that she was raped by a coworker on a trip to Las Vegas in the summer of 2016. He maintains that this sexual encounter was consensual, but she says that he forced himself on her despite her repeated attempts to tell him no. At the time, she didn't know much about the procedures for reporting sexual assault, and she didn't even think to take it to the police. She says she didn't speak to him about it again until this moment, more than a year later, when she asked him for the paternity test to rule him out as a potential father.
And the day that I got the email for the results, my heart sank to my stomach. I was driving back from lunch, checking my email while I'm driving, and it said 99.99% he was the father.
What was going through your mind at that time?
I was a little bit, I had so many mixed feelings. I mean, I can't even describe it. It was just like confused, angry. It wasn't consensual. I don't know him. I never lived with him. I was never in a relationship with him. It was just like a explosion of feelings and emotions in my mind.
You know, with abortion laws changing, more and more women are going to find themselves in situations like Teresa's, carrying pregnancies to term that resulted from rape. But I don't think we're talking enough about what happens afterward, what it's like to live with the reality of raising that child.
People who make laws haven't been raped, or they don't know what it's like living in our shoes and what our world is. I feel like I live in a bubble because I'm a single parent of twins, which is hard naturally by itself, but also twins conceived from rape and sharing custody with my rapist. No one really can relate to my struggle. No one can relate to my world.
In my reporting, I talked to a researcher at the University of Virginia named Lucy Guarnera. She works at the Institute of Law, Psychiatry, and Public Policy, and she's one of the very few people who have studied this issue in depth. She says that once women give birth, they're often tied to their assailants through the legal system, through the family court system, for the next 18 years.
We've got 50 different states in this country with 50 different systems, but in many states, you require a conviction for first-degree rape, which is really hard to come by, even if there's a lot of evidence, in order to terminate parental rights of a rapist's father.
You might wonder why a man who fathers a child through rape would even want custody or visitation or parental rights or any involvement with a child. For one, there's the issue of money. Generally speaking, the more custody a parent has, the less they'd be required to pay in child support. But it can also be about control. As part of her research, Guarnera talked to dozens of women in these situations, and the stories that they've told her are pretty grim.
So I had multiple participants talk about rapist fathers who, you know, while they were pregnant or shortly after they gave birth, threatened them or blackmailed them and said, hey, if you go to police or you continue cooperating with police, I am going to make your life a living hell. I am going to get access, custody and visitation access to your child. I'm never going to stop until I have full custody. So, you know, you better drop that criminal case right now. And in some circumstances, this worked. I have one woman I'm thinking of specifically where she wanted to place a child for adoption. And the perpetrator said, if you place that child for adoption, I will get custody because you've relinquished your parental rights unless you agree to drop this criminal case. And so she did, because she was more concerned about securing a safe life for her child than she was about potentially landing this guy in jail.
I found it really striking when she started reading to me from literal transcripts of the conversations she's had with these women.
One of my participants said to me when I asked, you know, why you think your assailant went after custody, she said, to hurt me. You know, if he couldn't have me, he wanted what I had. Oh no, he doesn't care about my son at all. He cares about making my life miserable. I know that sounds really conceited, but I swear to God, that's what it is. Another participant shared a similar sentiment. She said, he made it very obvious that he didn't want to be a father. He wanted to control me. I think it's just all for control, you know? He didn't want me to have the baby, and then me having the baby, I was kind of taking control of my own body, taking control of my decision to have her. So, you know, the next best thing to kind of ruin me for disobeying him and taking that power away from him is to try to take her away from me. I don't know if a power trip is the word I'm looking for, but I think that's what it is, and it's all just for power. I mean, isn't that what sexual assault is? You just want to overpower your victim.
As far as child support, I opened and closed so many cases because I wanted to put him on, but then I was scared. I was scared that he would just turn into this monster and just be so harsh towards me, and I just wanted to keep the peace. And I suffered because of that.
Teresa says she kept things pretty informal between her and the twins' dad for a while. He'd help out with money, or he'd come over to visit once a week, but he didn't want a formal court arrangement. But when the twins were two, Teresa did finally file for child support because she felt that she was eligible for more money than she was getting through the informal arrangement with their dad.
His attitude towards me totally changed. He said, okay, well, I want 50-50 custody because that should be half and I'm entitled to 50-50 custody. And I said, well, you know, I don't agree with that. And, you know, maybe when they get older, you know, if they want to be with you more, maybe it should be their choice. But I don't agree with that right now. They're not even 2 years old yet. And I don't even know you. And I don't know your girlfriend. And I don't even know your family.
When I spoke to the twins' dad, he denied that his pursuit of custody is in any way tied to money. And he declined to answer other questions about the case. Ultimately, it went in front of a family court judge. For various reasons, the rape allegations were essentially set aside. The judge told Teresa, basically, that while she was entitled to her version of events, her coworker was also entitled to his. He was granted partial custody of the toddlers, and Teresa says the day the kids first went to his house under that arrangement is burned into her memory.
I never will forget how I felt. I was, I had the most anxiety. I've never had anxiety in my life. But that was the most anxiety I had. My daughter actually threw up in the car seat, putting him in his car because she didn't want to go. They didn't know what was happening to them. They were two, just turned, you know, two in April at the time, and this is in June. So I just felt sick to my stomach, like, what is happening? Why do I have to put my kids through this? And it was the worst day of my life.
I want to hear more about how this process has affected your kids. Have you thought about how you're going to explain your relationship with their dad to them?
Yes. I think I'm going to be honest. I'm going to tell the truth. I'm not going to do anything that is negative because, you know, in our orders, it says that neither parent shall speak negatively. So, you know, we have to keep all that stuff private from them. But I want to be honest with them. When they're of age, you know, 18 or older, I want them to know the truth. I am an advocate for sexual assault survivors. It's a cautionary tale to men and women, and I want my daughter to be safe. I want my son to know no means no, and stop means stop. It doesn't matter even if you guys had sex before or even in the middle of having sex, no means no, stop means stop. And I think it's fair that they know the truth because we weren't in a relationship. I mean, that's a fact. We weren't living together. We weren't dating. He was just a coworker who unfortunately sexual assaulted their mother and he has custody.
For Guarnera, the researcher at UVA, the biggest obstacle facing women in these situations is a lack of access to the right information. So few women who find themselves pregnant as a result of rape know what to do, who to turn to for legal advice, or even how to begin navigating the family court system.
So many women I talked to brought up these unintended consequences of doing one thing that they just had no idea would have a negative effect on them later on. And if they had known, they could have chosen differently. So for example, one woman I spoke to talked about how she chose to put the perpetrator's name on the birth certificate because she felt like this was some sort of affirmation of what he had done, of saying, yes, he really is the biological father of this child. And she thought it would be easier for her to get child support that way. But it turned out later on, the fact that his name was on the birth certificate made it much easier for him to sue for custody because it was some sort of acknowledgement that he was a quote unquote real parent. A woman I interviewed explained that towards the very end of her pregnancy, you know, she's about to give birth, pregnancy resulting from rape. She wrote on Facebook to a friend, you know, hey, I'm excited about being a mother. I can't believe that this baby is about to be born. And in fact, that Facebook post was used in court in a custody case against the perpetrator to argue that she hadn't actually been raped, because the thinking goes, hey, if you were really raped, you wouldn't be happy about a pregnancy or about an impending birth, so you must be lying.
There is another procedure, a civil rather than criminal one, that some states have adopted. It came about during the Obama administration. In 2015, Obama signed a law encouraging states to make it easier for women in Teresa's case. Essentially, it allowed states to terminate parental rights of a father without a criminal rape conviction. It just requires enough evidence, clear and convincing evidence, it's called, that the child was conceived in rape. This is a lower standard of evidence than the criminal beyond a reasonable doubt one, but it's still difficult for women to prevail. And there's not much research about how common this procedure is, how often it's used, or whether it's successful in protecting women in Teresa's situation.
A lot of these women's outcomes depended on it, and I hate to say it, it seemed like arbitrary chance, you know, whether they happened to be raped by someone who was going to interfere with their lives or not, whether they happened to encounter a police officer or a prosecutor who, you know, knew enough to do the right thing. This is arbitrariness, and this is not a good way to assure that women are getting what they need.
You have to understand, we're talking about a legal system, judges, prosecutors, social workers, many of whom just don't understand how a woman would act after becoming pregnant as a result of rape. For instance, even reading the transcripts from some of Teresa's hearings, I was shocked how quickly the judge seemed to assume that she was just some sort of disgruntled ex. It was almost as though once her twins were born, any consideration of the circumstances around their birth was relegated to this past. It was like a door was closed and she couldn't go back there.
I've been told to get over the rape. And that happened in the past. And I compared that to like having a cancer diagnosis. You know, you wouldn't tell somebody, get over your cancer. PTSD, rape, sexual assault, those survivors, you know, sometimes they can get over it and go to therapy and forget about it. But it's a traumatic experience that now I have to face every day. To call my twins, I have to go through him. So I can't get over something that mentally, if I wasn't strong enough and stable enough, I would have taken my life.
I'm wondering if you'd known from the start who the father was, would you have considered other options, maybe arranging for an adoption or trying to get an abortion? It's difficult to think about because your kids are now such an important part of your life. But I ask because it must have been really daunting to realize that both you and your children were in some way going to be exposed to someone who'd harmed you.
Correct. And if I would have known, I would have reported it sooner. I would have reported the assault. I would have tried to, you know, have the law hold him accountable to what he did so that for my protection and for my children, he would have limited rights, if any at all. And as far as the twin pregnancy, if I did know that he was the father, I still would have kept them. I have great support from my family. My parents come from big families. So I felt pretty good about knowing that I was going to have a village and family support to keep this pregnancy. I think, you know, I would have just hoped and trusted that the laws and the legal side would have protected me from being forced to anything that I didn't feel comfortable or agree with.
You know, I went into this story really tightly focused on the question of rape exceptions in abortion legislation, how they could sort of prevent the situations that came up for the mothers I spoke to. And as a result, I was kind of primed to see the absence of rape exceptions in this legislation, or the removal of them, as a kind of catastrophic event. And it is. But the reality is, these exceptions are far less effective than we assume they are. They create this false impression that we're taking care of all rape survivors, when actually we're not. So, on the one hand, if you support full abortion bans with no exceptions, you need to recognize that what that means is mothers might end up sharing custody against their will with their rapists. On the other hand, if you advocate for reproductive choice, you still need to acknowledge that these exceptions aren't doing nearly enough, or nearly as much as we think they are, to support rape survivors. And we need to do a whole lot better.
Contributing writer Eren Orbe. He wrote about an anti-abortion activist's quest to end the rape exception. And you can find that story at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Hilton Ells is a longtime staff writer for the magazine and one of the best cultural critics working today. Recently, Hilton wrote about a new book called To the Realization of Perfect Helplessness. It's by the poet Robin Cost Lewis, and it was inspired by a collection of family photographs. It's a book, Hilton says, about how the dead do not stay dead. Robin Cost Lewis joined Hilton Ells on our program in 2016 after the release of her last poetry collection, her debut, Voyage of the Sable Venus, won the National Book Award for Poetry.
Oh my God, this book is one of the high points of my life. I begged to review it.
Thank you.
And I said, she's going to win this award.
Yeah, I'm glad everybody knew. I didn't know.
Voyage of the Sable Venus took its name from an 18th century engraving.
Because there's a gorgeous black woman on a clamshell like Botticelli's Venus, and she's attended by all these classical figures. And it isn't until you really look at that you realize it's a pro-slavery image, because Triton or Neptune is carrying, instead of a trident, he's carrying a flag of the Union Jack.
That got her interested in images of black women in Western art, a research project that got much bigger than she ever anticipated.
It just spurred me on. It was like, well, wait a minute, damn it.
Mm-hmm.
If this title is so complicated and so rich, what are other titles doing?
Mm-hmm.
And it just led me on this whole path. And I really thought at the time it was going to be a few pages long. And then every time I would do research, it would just get darker and deeper and longer and more horrid. It just didn't stop. It didn't let up. The Western Art Project, as beautiful as it is, it also has such an ugly underside.
Yes.
For so many kinds of people.
Well, it had to hack away
Absolutely.
Other things in order to stand on something, right?
Right. So, you know, like for me, if I would go into a museum and see some kind of grand historical painting about some emperor doing something fabulous,
mm-hmm.
conquering some land, there might not have been a black woman in that painting, but the frame might have had black female bodies carved throughout it.
Yes.
In some kind of subservient position.
Yes.
Do you know? And we're not supposed to notice that frame. and we're not supposed to think about it, but yes. It's there. And that's what was so fascinating to me, is that there are so many Black women in exhibitions all over the world, in every time period, in every country, every continent. It's everywhere. But you wouldn't think of it, because who would think to look at the carving of a comb closely?
Yes.
Or the face of a button. Yes. For an emperor, why would someone need to carve a Black female body onto the button of an emperor? Yes. Why?
Yes.
You know, and then when you start looking just for that, that's when it begins to kind of emerge.
Yes.
I don't know that I would have seen that had my brain not slowed me down and made me look more slowly.
Yes. I know that you began writing poetry because of something that happened.
Yeah.
Would you mind talking about it?
Not at all. I was in what they call a catastrophic accident. I fell through an open stairwell, and I...
What does that mean? There were no stairs?
There was no rail. That I didn't know, and it was a dark room, and I was going to get my coat in a restaurant, and they failed to tell me there was a hole in the middle of the floor, and I walked into air.
Where was this?
In San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
I was at a conference, and I was just having dinner with a friend, and I got cold, and I asked for my coat. And they led me back to this room and said, it's over there. And I could see my coat hanging on a wall, but I couldn't see the hole in the floor.
Oh, my God.
So I fell through. And for the last, I guess it's 16 years now, I've been doing a lot of rehab and recovery, and... What was the effect
of the falling?
Well, oh, thank you. So I was diagnosed with permanent mild to moderate brain damage, so a traumatic brain injury.
Oh, my God.
And then I had all kinds of injuries all over my body. I still have so many surgeries to have that I'll be going into soon. But the most kind of devastating part of it was the brain injury.
Yes.
And... at some point, I couldn't read or write, and I was they call it exquisite hypersensitivity. Everything triggered some kind of symptom, talking, walking, seeing, hearing, smelling, you name it, anything that had to do with the senses would send me into a spiral where I would end up sleeping for days upon days. My memory, I fought really hard for a year to teach myself the alphabet again. It took a year just to do that because the language center of my brain was badly damaged. But, you know, I hate to be that person that is always looking for the green side of something, but it turned out to be, in many ways, a blessing in disguise. I call brain damage the gift that keeps on taking, you know? and I don't think that I joke with my friends that this book is actually about brain damage.
Mm-hmm.
I know I would not have written this book had I not had that accident. So partly because if I'm going to die, I can write whatever the hell I want.
Exactly. You're free.
I'm so free.
Yes.
And there's no one to care about much in terms of pleasing. But also, the doctors told me I can only write one line a day, and I could only read one line a day. And that, of course, spiraled me into an incredible depression for several months. And then at some point, you know how that grace, that voice of grace just comes into your mind, and this voice just said to me, okay then, it's going to be the best damn line I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
And so every single day I would spend in bed thinking of the best line, and I couldn't write because my hands were all in different casts and all kinds of splints.
Were you a mother when you had this accident?
No. They also told me I couldn't have a kid. Told me I could never write again, teach again, read again, and not become a mother.
And you've done all
those things. I've done all those things.
You know, this is...
I was annoyed. I was enraged.
Yes. There's nothing like being annoyed to get
absolutely
the juices going.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Tell me about your son, and how did that miracle occur to you?
Oh, my God. What do you mean?
Well, I know how it happens. But the decision to...
There's a bird and there's a bee.
Yes, exactly. There's a stork and a diaper.
Exactly.
But how did you decide to become a mother?
This is such a great question. I have been haunted with being a mother all my life.
Really?
Yeah. I'm one of those crazy women who just always wanted to be a mother. And when they told me I couldn't have kids, I really had to think about it, and I thought about it for like a decade. You know, What does it mean to be a disabled woman and to have a child? And don't be selfish and mess with this kid's life if you can't really raise him or her well. And then one day I was walking down the street in Boston. I was doing major rehabilitation at the time. I was in occupational therapy, speech language therapy, just, you know, going outside would hurt. Mm-hmm. And one day I'd gone to do something and there was a woman, this gorgeous woman in a power wheelchair, mm-hmm. wheeling down the street at what felt like to me 60 miles per hour with two of her kids on her lap.
Wow.
She was like high-tailing it, and they were having such a good time. And I was like, you idiot. If this woman can raise her kids, you can have a kid. Wow. And she was such my inspiration. And so then I was hell-bent, and I tried and tried and tried for many, many years, and then it finally happened. Finally happened. And the deep irony for me is that my father was the first person to tell me way before my accident, I think you really should have a baby, Robin. You want to be a mother, you should just do it. My father was incredible. He was funny too.
I love him already.
Oh, he was so good.
Yes.
And the deep irony is I found out after years of trying to get pregnant, I found out I was pregnant 4 days after my father's funeral.
Oh, wow.
Which felt so magical to me because I always told him, you know, when you die, you better take me with you because there's no reason I'm staying without you.
Yes.
And so the fact that when I found out I was pregnant, it felt like he stayed with me in some way.
How does the accident impact you today?
Well, I mean, I've grown comfortable with being brain damaged.
Yes.
It's become familiar. You know that saying that human beings can get used to anything?
Yeah.
I got used to it.
You work around it.
I work around it. I've learned how to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. I know when sometimes I was just at a party on Friday in Miami at the book fest and I was starting to get symptomatic and I was like, you should just go.
Yes.
You have a reading tomorrow and if you don't go and go to sleep, you know, by the morning, face will be numb, your left arm will be numb, you won't be able to remember how to spell your name or that even where you are.
Yes.
So just go to bed.
Okay.
In those ways, but then also in lovely ways, you know, I still, I still very much appreciate that my brain has become an odd little bedfellow with
yes,
me.
Yes.
Like, we love each other. Like, I'm like, you're a freak brain.
Yeah.
And that's kind of sexy to me.
Yeah.
I like that you see these things that other people aren't seeing.
Yes.
But keep it to yourself and we'll try to turn it into art at some
yes,
point.
Yes.
In those ways.
It changed your perspective profoundly.
Absolutely. And
does it help you parent in a different way, do you think?
Absolutely. It helps me put it in fifth gear every day.
Yes.
From the gate. And, you know,
you wake up with him and it's like, look, we're here.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes.
And also, I mean, this is the macabre part. Like, supposedly my brain won't last as long as most people's brains will last. I know that. And I think that's also why I push myself so hard to write.
Yes.
And there's a certain urgency. Like, I feel like I'm fighting the clock until my brain starts to rot.
Yes.
And so I try to have a lot of fun. I try to parent him for the future. Like, mm-hmm. I have a whole library for him once I'm gone. I have friends sign books to him for the future because I know there's going to come a time where I won't be able to be present in
yes.
the same way
yes.
that I am now.
So do you talk to him about that?
I do. I mean, I had to because my disability is invisible.
Yes.
And so the way I described it to him when he was younger, I said, it's like mommy's brain is in a wheelchair. You know, and sometimes, you know, it's hard because, you know, he's a gregarious, precocious, fabulous child. And, you know,
he's about eight now.
He's seven. And I have to tell him sometimes to be quiet. That's a drag.
Yeah.
It's just a drag. Or I can't, you know, I'm sad that he doesn't know the person before my accident because I was a huge audiophile. I mean, like, a music collection that's brilliant. And I can't listen to music and have people talking at the same time in a room unless it's a lot of people talking. So things like that, like I feel like I'm constantly repressing his little spirit in ways in order to stay asymptomatic and like take care of him or make him dinner.
Yes.
So in those ways, but it's also okay because I feel like, you know, he's getting to learn about the ways in which bodies are different.
And also the ways in which life curtails us.
Absolutely.
Poet Robin Cost Lewis. She spoke with the New Yorker's Hilton Isles in 2016. Her new book is To the Realization of Perfect Helplessness. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I want to thank you for joining us today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Max Balton, Rita Green, Adam Howard, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Jeffrey Masters, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Imputabuele, with guidance from Emily Botine and assistance from Harrison Keithline and Meher Bhatia. And we had original music this week by Ngofen Imputabuele. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.